Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, April 24th, 2020. Every week, we check in with Publishers Weekly for the latest news on books and reading. Once again, Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, joins me from his home office in New York City. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So, Andrew, the numbers for the coronavirus pandemic of 2020 continue to mount. 2.5 million confirmed cases worldwide, more than 175,000 deaths, and half the world in confinement. Andrew, you have your own tally from New York, but let's start with how are you and yours keeping? Well, I hope.
Thank you. I'm doing okay so far. We're going on, what, day 39? I think day 40, actually, here in our stay-at-home lives. And so far, we have avoided the coronavirus, though the list does grow longer every day, I'm sad to say, of the people that my wife and I know who are battling COVID-19. And again, we'll just take this opportunity to reiterate what we say every week, and that's it. This illness is no joke. It is not a hoax. And while I think we've done a great job here in New York City of bending the curve, as hard as it is to be cooped up in the springtime, we can't stop now. You know, we've come this far. Don't give in now. Stay home, people. Let's really get this knocked down and we'll figure out what comes next when it won't put people's lives in danger. And I say that in full appreciation of the many people who are in danger, from the first responders and the medical personnel to essential employees at our local grocer to people who are economically vulnerable as well, which I have to say is more and more of us. We can talk a little bit more about who's economically vulnerable later. But Chris, you're healthy too, I presume?
Well, indeed I am, as well as can be expected. Thank you, Andrew. And from the health of our host and our guest, let's turn on Beyond the Book to the health of the publishing industry. This week, more numbers are in from the marketplace, and if it's been a roller coaster up to now, this week was one of the big drops.
Yeah, it has been a roller coaster week to week in terms of book sales, but that's largely because I think of the lag in sales reporting. And I think that we all know that eventually this roller coaster is just going to become one big stomach churning drop at some point soon. And I think this week we start to see that come into focus a little bit. So unit sales of print books through mid-April were only down about 3.5% compared to a similar period last year. This according to figures provided by NPD BookScan. And this includes Easter sales for both years. And it's when you look at those Easter sales, I think that we begin to see how rough a ride we may be in for. The Easter sales for 2020 are off about 20% compared to last year's Easter week. And in direct comparison, sales were down even more. So Easter fell on different days for the 2 years. But if you actually look at this week, I think that ended April 20th, sales were down almost 30%. Print unit sales in adult nonfiction were down 12.5%. Adult fiction actually did pretty well over this period. It actually went up a little bit. I think it was helped by the release of John Sanford's new book, Masked Prey, sold 29,000 copies in its first week on sale. So, you know, we are now in the teeth of this unprecedented crisis, and we're starting to see the impacts in the numbers. But as I said, I expect we're going to start seeing some precipitous declines when the lag starts. We start catching up with the lag in reporting.
And on Thursday, the House agreed on legislation for more funding for the Paycheck Protection Program. The U.S. Senate had already favorably passed on the bill. PW's reported on how booksellers and indie publishers are faring in terms of getting support. What did you find out?
Yeah, so, you know, it's not unlike what you're probably hearing in the media from a lot of small businesses around the country. Booksellers and indie publishers are mostly still awaiting funds from the landmark CARES Act, with indie publishers and booksellers reporting mixed, mostly bad experiences trying to actually secure this financial lifeline. So, you know, Angela Bowl, who is the CEO of the Independent Book Publishers Association, told PW that, you know, some of her members seem to have sailed through the application process, but many more are finding it really difficult to just interpret the application requirements, which over the first weeks have really shifted. Of course, you know, if you're not working closely with the bank, you're disadvantaged. And that's something the new legislation is hopefully going to address. We'll see. So we know that, for example, Red Hen Press co-founder Kate Gale told PW that she didn't know anyone in the arts world who had actually successfully gotten CARES Act funding secured yet. And, you know, she stressed how important these funds are for the 25-year-old Redhead Press. As with most small publishers, the biggest expenses they face are payroll and printing. And to keep publishing, you need to print and you need to keep your people on the job. And that's a familiar refrain we've heard and is reflected in the article by Alex Green and Claire Kirk, which is on the PW site now. A lot of small publishers and indie booksellers have just not been able to get their hands on these government funds.
And what exactly are you hearing about these challenging experiences?
Well, we're hearing a range of concerns. Redhead publisher Mark Cull, for example, said he had an appointment at Bank of America on the very first day applications were accepted for CARES funds, but he was turned away, even though Red Hen has had an account with the bank for a quarter of a century. And why was he turned away? Because the press didn't have a current loan with the bank. No doubt we've heard many of those stories in the media, and we've heard a number of them here at PW. Now, that policy has supposedly been changed at many banks, but after the policy adjustment, well, Red Hen immediately reapplied, but lost a spot in the metaphorical line for funds. And then, of course, the money ran out. Now, reports this week suggest that people who had pending applications won't have to reapply and will keep their place in line. But we'll see. We'll see what that means. And Angela Ball acknowledged that funding has been slow to arrive for most of her members who have managed to get through the application process. You know, it's just tough to navigate, right? And she attributed that to just the sheer size of the crisis response. You know, it's a $2.5 trillion stimulus act that was jammed through in about 90 hours. And, you know, we're just not used to doing that kind of thing in this country, right? And I think she's right. I think that is certainly a big part of this. Now, it's not going to get much better. And Nina Barrett, who's the owner of Bookends and Beginnings in Evanston, Illinois, told us that of the 100 fellow booksellers she knew who had sought for payroll support, only one had been successful. And this fight is going to continue. Now that new funding has been approved, it doesn't make the application process go any easier. You know, Barrett said she was a 30-year customer of Chase Bank, but the process left her in despair. The initial application forms were changed. The documents she was told to prepare via the bank's online portal were not the ones she needed when she went on the site. And then when she submitted on behalf of herself and her three employees, the site crashed, overwhelmed by people trying to apply. We have heard so many of these stories. You know, this is not to say that there is not hope. These funds are out there and they will hopefully come through, but this is not easy. And like other independent booksellers who spoke with PW, the process, Barrett says, left her without much faith that the program is going to be administered well, and suspicions about how even the new round of funds are going to be distributed, suggesting that, you know, once the new funds come in, banks are just, you know, going to take their biggest customers first. Meanwhile, another story on PW touches on how booksellers are also using crowdfunding and public outreach to fill the funding gap. And no question, these are kind of crucial days. There's a lot of concern about what the book business is going to look like after the crisis is over, and crowdfunding is definitely going to be part of this, but it's very uncertain times for sure.
Late last week, Andrew, PW Library columnist Sari Feldman published a post pondering the future of libraries after the pandemic, and her comments went viral.
Yeah, it's a really thoughtful column. We published it late on Friday afternoon after 5 o'clock, and it had already had over 1,000 Facebook likes in about 12 hours after it went up. It clearly hit a nerve with what people are thinking. And, you know, as I said, it's a really thoughtful column that raises a number of questions about what comes next. And, you know, some states today are supposedly reopening, right? They're reopening their economies, which is just so risky and frankly stupid. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anyone, but, you know, let me just say how much this endangers the future of many businesses, not only people, but businesses in the state, including bookstores. And, you know, people are not just, you know, facing a threat from the virus. If you own a small shop in Georgia, for example, you're supposed to be open, right? Which means your landlord is going to be demanding rent. But are you going to have any customers? And if you do, you're only going to be able to serve a handful at a time. So the best case is you're required to be open, but you have to serve a small fraction of your normal traffic, but you're going to have to pay full boat on your expenses. I mean, it's just not right. And we're not ready, but I digress. In her column, Sari makes this great observation that, you know, the value of public libraries is rarely questioned in times of crisis. And I think she's right. You think of the New Orleans Public Library after Hurricane Katrina, she writes. There was the Ferguson Municipal Public Library during the unrest there. And Baltimore, the Enoch Pratt Free Library during the unrest after Freddie Gray died at the hands of police. But this crisis is different, she argues. More specifically, the social distancing required to address this crisis is different because it strikes at the very foundation on which the modern public library rests. For example, does anyone doubt that COVID-19 is going to change some people's perspective on what can and should be shared? You know, how are libraries and their patrons going to view the circulation of physical library collections, including books? You know, it's a reasonable assumption, I think, that people are going to emerge from this public health crisis with a, shall we say, heightened sense of germ-related exposure. How many patrons, particularly those with means who can buy books, are going to question the safety of borrowing books and other items from the library? And in terms of library buildings, you know, open access for everyone on the stacks has long been a celebrated library value. Libraries are places where you once got shushed, but if you go into any public library today, they've become these vibrant social places where people are gathering and working together. Can we maintain that in an age of social distancing? Are computer stations going to have to be 6 feet apart? Are gloves going to need to be used for shared keyboards? Will parents and caregivers still want to bring their children to a Baby and Me program? These are all questions that Sari raises that I think are excellent questions. And seniors, are seniors going to still want to find respite in a library community? You know, this week, the IMLS dedicated some money to studying how to disinfect books once they've been loaned. But I would submit that you can't disinfect people's brains. Let's be honest. Some people, particularly people with comorbidities or people who were, you know, germophobes to begin with, are probably going to be very leery about handling shared materials for some time.
Sari Feldman also raises some questions about the library's relationship with publishers.
Yeah, and I think she's right on here, too. You know, how are public libraries in this crisis going to continue to lead on book and author discovery, where they play a supremely crucial role? You know, a number of librarians have taken to hosting Zoom chats with patrons, but, you know, with many library websites being refreshed less frequently and combine that with canceled author tours and a diluted publishing schedule during the crisis, and a lot of these librarians are being furloughed, it's increasingly challenging, I think, for libraries to be out front when it comes to new books and authors, which is where they like to be. Now, in terms of collections, many libraries have actually suspended purchases of print titles. You know, no one can go to the library to borrow them, right? And nobody's at the library to catalog them. So they've just stopped. So how many libraries are going to be able to double back at some point and buy copies of new print books that were published during the crisis for their collections and get them on the shelves? And of course, without proper logistical systems in place, some of these titles that were published during this crisis that don't get cataloged in print may not even make it into the library's catalog ever. And that would be a real shame. That would be a real gap, I think, in our publishing knowledge to not have those books on library shelves. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about how ebooks and digital audio and other streaming services have become essential during this crisis. But in the best of times, as we know well on this show, we've talked about it many times, the digital library market has been tenuous, marked by high prices, lend limits, other restrictions. And this sudden shift to digital now presents a whole new set of potential concerns, Sari argues, not the least of which is that this increase in digital usage does not come with additional support automatically for public library budgets. And these ebooks are significantly more expensive than their commercial counterparts, their consumer counterparts. And of course, without good access to cell phone or internet service, people who don't have that, they're excluded. They can't get ebooks right now. They can't get library service without a good internet connection. And there's still a significant portion of the population that falls into that category. But beyond cost and access, this new way of doing business could also impact the library's relationship with their community. For example, OverDrive, who supplies library ebooks to people who want to borrow them, they have a great app. It's called the Libby app. But what if the Libby app starts to get more traction with consumers than their local public library, who, you know, are behind the scenes paying the bills? Some observers have dubbed this crisis the Great Pause. But as Sari writes, librarians can't pause. They don't have the option. Librarians can't just sit back, wait for this to be over, and unlock the library doors again. Librarians really have to take this time to think about how public libraries are going to function in a society that's certainly going to be changed for the short term, she writes, and maybe changed forever. And frankly, I think that's probably good advice for all of us to start thinking about.
Andrew Albanese, PW Senior Writer, thanks for your reporting and analysis.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming up on Beyond the Book, with the world in lockdown during the COVID-19 pandemic, offices and classrooms where only weeks ago we would gather and collaborate are now off limits. While we work from home or study online, we see work and studies in a remarkable new light. Our workplace matters hardly at all, but our organization's culture is suddenly paramount. As the global health crisis grips the planet, William F. Baker sees an opportunity for the right kind of leadership that will keep employees healthy in body and in spirit.
It all depends on a combination of the leader, the culture of the institution, and a lot of good luck. You know, nobody was ready for this. It's almost impossible to be ready for something of this nature. But if you have a really healthy organization and you have caring leadership at the top, usually you get through it.
Bill Baker, President Emeritus of Channel 13 in New York and co-author with Michael O'Malley of Organizations for People. Next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening, and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.